Bacon. I'm here from the IBM Watson Research Center and temporarily on a sabbatical at Harvard, where I came in from. And I'm going to be talking about parallel and concurrent real-time garbage collection. I guess a couple of things up front. First of all, please feel free to interrupt with questions or digressions or anything. The more interactive we make it, I think the more fun it is. Second, I forgot my clicker, so I'm going to have to go up there to move through animations. So if I'm standing in front of something, feel free to tell me to get out of the way. Okay, so... I'd rather not mess around with it, maybe tomorrow. So let me start by showing you what our system does without telling you anything at all about how it works. Okay, so this is a Java virtual machine running a real-time music synthesizer running on not our stuff. And so you can see that there are these breaks in the waveform, and it sounds pretty awful. So that's pretty painful. Okay, so here it is running on top of our metronome garbage collector. Why is this bonking at me? It was a JVM from some company other than IBM. So now this is on our stuff. And at the top there, those are the MIDI. This is a MIDI-based synthesizer, so we're feeding MIDI note data in. And producing this waveform. And then let me get out of full screen. That was the trick. And then this is another thing that we did with it. We used it to control this thing here called the Javiator. So Java software is controlling this this thing here. So this was an excellent project because IBM paid me to work on music synthesis and helicopter design. I'm sorry? Yeah, that thing is scary. I don't know if you could see that we were wearing masks. It's all custom fabricated. What the hell is that sort of super lightweight plastic stuff called anyway? Okay, so that's what it does. And basically over the course of the next couple days, I'm going to be sort of taking you through how it works. I guess we can turn this off now. Okay, so what it is. Well, fundamentally what we've built is a garbage collector that is capable of running real-time software. You know, what that means at a very hand-wavy course level is We have 450 microsecond worst case latencies. That's about a factor of 1,000 or more better than what you get with a standard production virtual machine.
What parameters go into effect during that worst case latency? Presumably, if you've got more memory to work over,
That we should probably come back to that question sometime tomorrow when we've seen how all the stuff works. But so it's multi-processing, so it's using multiple CPUs at a time to collect in a shared memory, multi-threaded Java environment. It's concurrent, so it can run in the background while the application proceeds, and it can soak up extra CPU resources if they're available. And it's robust, you know, both within a single JVM and when you throw multiple JVMs on a single machine, it has sort of predictable and orderly behavior and minimal sort of interference. And the key thing is this is a production system. This is implemented and in IBM's product JVM and ships to a bunch of people who are using it. So why is this important? You might have read in the last couple of days about how Goldman Sachs is stealing everyone's money by doing this high-frequency trading stuff. So that's one big application area. Basically, they're... I didn't know why that was funny, but all right. So, you know, they're trying to do trades on the order of, you know, a millisecond, 2 milliseconds, 3 milliseconds end-to-end, or even, you know, now they're going to sub-millisecond. You know, even 3 years ago, that was sort of beyond what anyone was thinking about. When I first started talking to these people, I guess this was 2007, one of the things that had just happened was that one of the Wall Street companies thought they were doing very well because they had a, they were sort of trading on a 500 millisecond tick. And some other arbitrager came along and noticed that there was this kind of weird perturbation in the market every 500 milliseconds. And they got in there with a trading algorithm that exploited that and completely hosed the other company. So another thing is this next generation Navy destroyer. These people were actually our first customers. The software for that is going to be on the order, I think, in total of approaching 100 million lines of code. So maintainability and so on is really important to them. Ease of programmability is important. And interestingly, they're actually worried that if they write their code in C, that 30 years from now, when this thing is still floating around, no one will be graduating from college having learned how to program in C. This is a really serious... in some sense, it might have actually been the dominating factor that led them to choose to use Java. So telecom switches, right? The machines that run the sort of core switching architecture for telecom and so on, they need very low latencies and so on. Then you've got things like gaming, automotive electronics. CEO of BMW a number of years ago said that 80% of the value in their cars was coming from software, which is pretty incredible for a sort of sheet metal company like that. And then these are various things that that we did as research projects. We did the synthesizer, the Javiator, with the University of Salzburg and with the civil engineering people at Berkeley. They're doing these swarming autonomous UAVs, and you can guess who pays them to do that. Okay, so let me talk a little about the sort of progression of this project. So I first got interested in this in about 1999. And the first thing I did was I built with the colleagues there at IBM and Han Lee, from who was an intern from Colorado. We built a system called the Recycler. This was based on reference counting. And, you know, we got the PLDI paper and the NICU paper out of it. And it worked really well most of the time, but it had certain pathological behavior. So after working on that for 3 years, we basically threw it all away and started again with a totally different approach, and built a research prototype system called Metronome. Worked on that for 3 to 4 years. Perry Cheng came from CMU. Martin Vecchia was an intern from Cambridge. And then in late 2004, we connected up with those people doing the next generation destroyer, and I, you know, showed them what we could do, and they got very excited because they were basically completely hosed having tried this alternative development methodology. So we then wound up putting this technology initially, and then with a lot of refinements and extensions, in particular for multiprocessing, which we didn't handle in the original Metronome system, into the product, which to my dismay got called WebSphere Real-Time. WebSphere is IBM's, Java enterprise app server thing, and has nothing really to do with a Java virtual machine. This is all branding. And so the interesting thing here was that, you know, the team at research was a similar size all along. But then we had about 5 people in development. We had 10 people in test. And 5 people doing sales and strategic marketing and so on. So this was kind of like doing a sort of high-tech startup within IBM. And so at this point, we've probably brought in contracts with this worth on the order of $200-$250 million, so we're pretty happy. So I thought I'd take a little digression on keys to research success. As a student, I was certainly really hung up on how smart and talented I was, and kind of intimidated by my office mates who'd like scored number one on the IIT entrance exam and all that kind of stuff. Over time, I've come to believe that that's a lot less important. Being able to collaborate with people is really important. I'm not nearly as smart as a lot of people I went to grad school with, but if I can collaborate with people who are that smart, then I don't need to be that smart myself. And the really big one is problem selection, right? So I worked on that problem for 9 years. That's like a major chunk of your life. And usually you spend, a few months, maybe half a year, figuring out sort of what the next problem you're going to work on is. So I just kind of wanted to point that out and kind of get you to think about that what's going to determine your success long term, number one, is going to be what you decide to work on, because brilliant people who decide to work on pointless problems kind of doesn't matter. Of course, one man's pointless is another man's world changing, so kind of up to you to decide what you want. Kind of depending on what you're interested in, we can view this problem from a number of different perspectives. So you can think of concurrent garbage collection as sort of a key component of a runtime system. It's certainly that. You can also look at it as a really challenging verification or synthesis problem. This is about the most complicated concurrent algorithm you're likely to come across. And you know, I've done some work with some colleagues on that, but it's still very much an open problem. And if you're interested in concurrency and you know all of the hype around multiprocessing now, you know, this is also a really complex, multifaceted, concurrent algorithm. In a sense, it's really a system made up of many component algorithms. And so as we go through the system, I'll sort of describe these individual component algorithms and then show how they all fit together. So, you know, in terms of what I hope you'll get out of this, sort of one thing is to think about how to bridge from a sort of abstract design to a concrete implementation in a real system, and how to combine sort of these different components into a holistic whole that has to meet many different and sometimes competing goals. And then finally, to you know, hopefully get a really pretty deep understanding of a real-world system that's out there and deployed. So I guess, you know, in reference to, you know, yesterday's talk by Andre, we could call it a guided tour of a real-time concurrent collector. So let me start by kind of putting this in context. You know, I think academically speaking, you might think of a virtual machine as being comprised of that sort of top row, right? There's an interpreter, there's a JIT compiler, if it's a system that's performance-oriented, and there's a garbage collector. But in fact, the system that we're deploying has all of this other stuff in it. One of the things we have is an ahead of time compiler. So to get really deterministic performance, right, like in that music example I was showing you, the human ear can pick up a jitter on the order of maybe around 100 microseconds. And if you do synchronous JIT compilation, or even for some applications, if you're running in interpreted mode, which is 20x slower, you just won't be able to keep up. The product version of the system has an ahead-of-time compiler that lets you basically take a jar file, which is just a wrapped-up collection of classes, and generate machine code from them that gets loaded immediately. Some folks were asking yesterday about how do you make conservative assumptions, or how do you deal with trying to do static analysis and optimizing compilation when you're dealing with a language like Java where you can't necessarily make a closed world assumption. Well, this compiler basically you know, has to deal with that. So when there's a virtual method call, if it isn't declared final, then it's not able to inline it or turn it into a direct jump, because it has to be prepared for the fact that someone might load a new class which overrides that method. So you wind up getting into a sort of interesting determinism performance trade-off, because The ahead of time compiler is about, maybe 2x, 2.5x slower than the JIT, but still around 8x faster than the interpreter. And so, for instance, for the telecom people, they're willing to live with a certain amount of limited non-determinism up front because they have a sort of queued real-time model that they use. Right? They've just got kind of calls coming in that they're responding to, which has sort of a different set of requirements than doing synthesis of a single stream of music. So they actually run with the JIT, even though it means they have some performance problems in the beginning. And this is another thing, actually, that the Wall Street people had problems with, that they do these kind of rolling reboots of their systems as a way of keeping them reliable, or dealing with the fact that they're not reliable, right? Basically, their systems sort of accumulate cruft over time, and so they just periodically will reboot their machines in such a way that there's always some that are up that can service requests. But then they got in the problem that, a new machine would come up, and then the first few transactions going in would take a very long time because they'd all be jitting first time through, and, then after that other experience that I told you about, they were very paranoid about people exploiting that kind of thing. Okay, so this virtual machine also implements this so-called real-time specification for Java. These are a bunch of extensions to Java designed for real-time. I'm not going to talk about those really today. The class loader and unloader, this is actually a pretty complicated subsystem in the virtual machine. So this is the thing that takes care of loading a class from a file or over the net or whatever. Sort of very tied into the object model. And Java specifies that you have to be able to unload a class when it's no longer used. Now you can imagine that that can be a very hairy synchronization problem when you've got the class, maybe there are objects of that class or not, you have to figure out whether there are. Meanwhile, there are threads out there that might be trying to new objects of that type. You've got pointers to jitted code, you want to clean up that code. That's already a pretty hairy piece of software. And now we had to extend that so that we could unload a class in real time, right? We couldn't just sort of stop the system and sort of look around and say, well, is anyone using this class? No. All right, blow it away. Then a bunch of stuff that wasn't too affected. JVMPI, or TI for profiling, all sorts of debug support, what IBM calls RAS, reliability, availability, and serviceability. This is kind of stuff so that sysadmins can connect into a running VM and figure out what's going on. Related to that, various system management things. Weird references. Java, this is another thing that you don't normally think about when you're looking at garbage collection algorithms. Java has about, or in the JVM, there's maybe 5-6 different kinds of special pointers. So there are these language-level things called weak references, soft references, and phantom references. These are all designed so that you can have things like weak hash tables, where if there's no longer a reference to something in the hash table from anywhere outside of the hash table, then the thing will get collected, right? Because otherwise your hash table can just grow and grow and grow, even though you're not referencing the thing in it anymore. Then there's these JNI references, right? When you're interfacing to native code, you can have C code that gets a handle to a Java object. There are special references that may get created when you do synchronization, where there's sort of a pointer to a synchronization object, which then refers to the Java object. So dealing with all of these things is a significantly complex piece of the virtual machine, and it's a significant piece of the code for our garbage collector. And then you need these sort of various sort of crash diagnosis tools, right? So you have to make sure that you've set things up so that you can, when your JVM crashes, you write an image, a memory image out to a file, and there's then a tool that can parse that file and go through and say, oh, that's an object. You know, this over here is the beginning of an object, and so on and so forth. That puts certain constraints on how you can do your object model and so on and so forth. Then you've got class libraries, right? So for instance, if you do an array copy operation in Java, that's not written as a loop in Java that just does character by character copy. It's dispatching to something underneath that's written in C that says, okay, what's the offset? Is there any overlap? What's the alignment? Then it'll try to do mem copies and things like that, which eventually will get turned in some cases into special block copy instructions depending on the underlying machine architecture. So all of those things, a lot of those things are written in C. Sometimes they're machine dependent. So we wound up having to make some significant changes there. Documentation. I hate writing documentation. And then, like I said, close to half of the people who worked on the product were doing test. Right? I mean, think about that, half the people. Because we had to have a system that not only was able of staying up, for several weeks at least, but that was able to do that without missing real-time deadlines over the course of several weeks. So that's a lot of testing. So I just kind of wanted to give you a sense of what a real production virtual machine is and sort of all of the moving parts. We're going to be concentrating primarily on the GC, of course. We'll talk some about the weird references and some of the interactions with these various components. So any questions on that so far? All right. So what are the fundamental issues that we have to address in building this real-time concurrent collector? Of course, there's functional correctness. That actually turns out to be quite hard when you're building a system of this level of complexity. It's one of the reasons we'd like to have verification, right? They're going to be running a battleship on top of this software. It'd be kind of a bummer if it crashed at the wrong time. We have to deal with liveness issues. I mean, if you've taken some sort of theoretical algorithms classes, you may have dealt with liveness issues, proving liveness and so on. But liveness per se is a theoretical issue. Just says something like, well, eventually we'll make progress, right? And for us, eventually isn't good enough. So we also have to be able to talk about timeliness and be able to say something about, how many microseconds will it be before this thing happens? Fairness is another sort of classical concurrent algorithms problem. So if we have multiple threads running, we want to treat them fairly if they're competing for resources. But because we're in a real-time world, we have to do that in a context where there are also user-specified priorities for threads, which are essentially a way of specifying unfairness. And so all of these things have to interact with each other cleanly. Initiation and termination. This turns out to be a really large part of the system, probably in terms of lines of code. The stuff to do the initiation, termination, phase change is maybe 50-60% of the code. Actually, it's probably more like 40, and then another 30 is weird references, and then 30% is actually the sort of meat of the algorithm. You have to deal with contention. So, you know, what happens when you have some sort of shared resources or shared work that you're trying to do? Make sure that that doesn't interfere with your level of concurrency or your determinism. And then in all sorts of various ways, you have to deal with the existence of various kinds of non-determinism, like cache misses and, branch prediction and so on and so forth. So why is concurrency hard? Come on, all of you can at least give me one answer, right? Oh, no, you don't get to answer. Sorry?
Nasty to debug.
True. Why is it nasty to debug?
Because execution is not deterministic.
Okay. All right, now you can go. I'm sorry?
Maybe I think one way being trained to think sequentially.
Okay.
Come on, there's got to be more than that. I just taught an undergrad class at Harvard. It was my first time teaching, and so I had to train myself to not keep on when there's deafening silence in the class. So I'm going to use that. I'm going to use that here. How about you? What do you think? No, him. You can go next.
Which, once again, sort of fundamentally comes back to the non-determinism.
It's hard to reason about what your interleavings or other interactions you might see when looking at one specific chunk of code.
Right. Okay. We'll look at a couple examples of that before too long. All right. Well,
so I'd actually contend that in a lot of ways, you could sort of think about it as that it's only hard because of performance, right? In a lot of cases, if you didn't care too much about performance, then you could use an implementation that was actually pretty easy to reason about. But the more you care about performance, the hairier your algorithm gets, and you start having to deal with issues of contention, when you try to make a better load balance, that complicates the algorithm. And then you're constantly fighting this granularity overhead issue, right? You'd like to break things up into small pieces of work that you can spread around, but then the synchronization overhead kills you and you're sort of constantly futzing around with that balance. Then you have systems where there is actually some inherent simultaneity that you can't get away from. So if I have two people sitting at two different MIDI keyboards funneled into my synthesizer, there's some inherent simultaneity there that's part of the actual real-world problem that I'm trying to solve and not caused by the fact that I'm trying to do a good job of solving it. And then there's timing and determinism, right? If we throw real time into it, then you know, not only do we have to deal with all of these problems that come up here, we have to sort of make sure that that we can actually say something about what happens in every execution, whereas most performance engineering that gets done in a traditional virtual machine is really oriented around average case optimization. So, you know, over the course of doing this research in real time, which was not my background when I started working on the problem, I've come to think of sort of timing and real time as sort of the ultimate de-bullshitter, right? Because if you, you know, it's very easy to build systems where you sort of hide behind this level of virtualization, and you know, you, there are these corner cases, and you just sort of let the virtual memory system deal with it, or you sort of let the let something like VMware deal with things. So when you have to deal with time, it forces you to really understand your algorithm and build something that sort of works at a deeper level. So fundamentally, garbage collection is a really simple problem, right? It's transitive graph closure, the end, right? So I've got a stock, it's a couple of pointers. All of my objects in the talk are going to be of type foo, which has two foo pointers in it, A and B. Okay, so I've got this object graph in the blue heap here. And let's see, I think I have an animation here. Oops, no. And so, right, well, W is certainly alive. It's pointed to from the stack. X is alive. It's pointed to from the stack. Y and Z are alive. But T and U, even though they're part of the graph, aren't alive because they're not in the transitive closure of the pointers in the stack. So, you know, as we sort of go through this over the next few days, the thing gets hairier and hairier and hairier, sort of keep in the back of your mind that all we're doing is building this big transitive closure engine. So there's kind of a couple of really basic approaches that people have developed starting in 1960 or so with the introduction of Lisp. The first one is mark and sweep. Okay, so the idea here is you sort of start with the stack variables and you follow the pointers, and then when you come to X, you're going to actually stack the pointer you haven't gone to B there. You follow the A pointer. Then there's no pointers in Y. You come back, you go to Z. You'll follow the A pointer to Y, but that's already been marked, right? So there's some sort of bit associated with each of these objects that I'm representing with a color. And then you go to R and follow the pointers from that. And now you've got this set of live things. That's our transitive closure. And now we're going to take anything that hasn't been marked as free. And so we're just going to scan through memory and move anything that's free onto this free list, and now when we want to allocate new things, we just go to that free list and pull things off the data structure. So That's good because the mark phase is order of live memory. It's bad because the sweep is order of the heap size. It's good because it usually requires no copying, but it's maybe bad because you have to keep this mark stack as you're doing the graph traversal that can be as large as the maximum depth of the data of a data structure. So if some schmuck were to use a gigabyte linked list, you'd have to have a pretty deep mark stack. The other approach is what's called semi-space copying. You basically go through, you divide memory into two so-called semi-spaces. You go through the one, move it over to the other, and then blow this one away. You start allocating in here. I'm not going to go into the details, but there's this this very cute algorithm that lets you avoid having a mark stack. You just kind of keep two cursors as you're moving along. That lets you avoid the mark stack problem. Of course, that only works if it's single-threaded. So an upside is that, you know, it keeps your objects compacted. So in a lot of cases, it has good memory locality. Downside is that from the get-go, you're throwing away half your memory space. And by the way, I guess I'll mention that in production, no one uses a JVM where it's paging, right? If you try to run a garbage collection algorithm and the thing starts paging, it's really god-awful. And so, you know, in practice, what people will do is they'll just go out and buy enough memory and sort of set things up so that they're not doing that. People have been doing research recently on how to have GC-aware paging systems, but none of that's gotten into production yet. Okay, so let's talk about the kinds of different collection. So the standard thing that you'd sort of initially see is what's called stop the world collection. So you have one or more application threads running, those green threads. You run out of memory, and you then start doing garbage collection. It's one thread. It sits there. You know, it has a nice coherent view of the heap. You can use that cute algorithm I told you about because you're not trying to have multiple threads work on the thing. But of course, you're interrupting the application for a long time, and if you've got a lot of processors, you're wasting a lot of resources. You can do parallel collection where you stop the world, but then the garbage collector itself is a parallel algorithm. Okay, so that's good because the collection happens more quickly. I guess I should have drawn that a little narrower. So the latency goes down, the processor utilization goes up. Next thing you can do is you can make it concurrent, right? So you can set it up so that the collector can run on one thread while the application proceeds on other threads. So here you've got, here you have to deal with concurrency between the collector and itself and other threads doing collection. Here you've got to worry about concurrency between the collector and the application threads. And then finally, you can do incremental collection where instead of doing the work in one monolithic piece, we break it up into a bunch of little pieces, and that makes the latencies seen by the application smaller.
Would you consider generational collectors be variant of incremental?
Well, so a generational system, it's a bit of an orthogonal axis. It's typically a stop-the-world collection, but it's only collecting a subset of the memory. So you get shorter average case latencies, but it does nothing to change your worst case latency. It can also give you better locality, and it can let you reduce the size of your overall heap. So almost always a good thing to do, but okay, so the system we're going to talk about is all of the above. So it's parallel, it's incremental, and it's concurrent.
What combinations of those three don't make sense? Can we go back?
What combinations don't make sense?
Is there anything that is concurrent and parallel that cannot be incremental? Because it seems that the hardest problem is that you solve, so you can really make it.
Okay. In parallel and incremental, there's no GC application concurrency. So in some sense, you know, concurrent is often the hardest one. In some sense, concurrent and incremental are the most similar. Because here you have to deal with actual true cycle-by-cycle concurrency between these things. Here, you don't have to quite deal with concurrency on that level, but you do have to deal with the fact that between this piece of work and this piece of work, the application may have changed the shape of the heap graph. And that, so I guess I would say, if you solve incremental, you solve a lot of the problems of concurrent, but not all of them. Parallel is really kind of different from those.
But if you've solved concurrent, have you not solved all the problems of incremental?
I guess there. I guess maybe one way to say it is, here there's a whole scheduling issue, which is non-trivial. If you were willing to just let this turn out to be sort of arbitrary slices smattered about, and you considered that to be incremental, then yes. If you care about how and when and how wide the increments are, then no. Right, because you have to make sure that, like, I don't grab some lock right there and hold it all the way here, which prevents anyone from doing any allocation in here. There's a lot of shared aspects to the problems, but I don't think you can really sort of so cleanly tease them apart. But I think most of the combinations make sense. But sorry? So you're talking about papers that have titles like a mostly concurrent collector?
I'm talking about the product
a lot of systems have algorithms that are that have some feature of either being mostly parallel or mostly concurrent. And the way they'll sort of work is they'll kind of try to do most of the work, right? And then they'll get to some point and they'll say, gee, I don't have a lot of work left to do, but now I have to figure out this really hairy stuff of, is there any kind of race between the collector and the mutator? And then they stop the world, and then they sort of say, well, we won't have to stop the world for very long because we've only got a few things on our work list. But you can't make any guarantee, right? Because you might follow one thing on the work list, discover that someone flipped some pointers, and now there's a whole new big data structure that you have to traverse. So those, we've seen in the field, those things have 250 millisecond latencies when they're trying to do that final short phase. But I'm sorry, that it's what? You mean in the things you download as a JVM, or? Well, so I mean, this system I'm describing is fully concurrent. A lot of systems are mostly concurrent, right? And as I sort of show you all the different phases and pieces of the algorithm, right? Like what a lot of people will do is they'll make it sort of 85% current or concurrent or 95% concurrent. But because there's all of these special cases that you have to deal with, right? Real time is a worst case thing. And so that's why I was sort of saying that there's all of these weird things you have to deal with that take up, you know, some large fraction of the code base and take up often 0% of the execution time. We can kind of re-raise that issue as you see more pieces of the system. Okay, so it's parallel, incremental, and concurrent, and then on top of that, it's real time. So there's no increment exceeding 450 microseconds, but on top of that, we have to make sure that those increments are spaced out very smoothly and predictably. So there's a significant piece of scheduling work that's going on there. Excuse me. And then, you know, a really key thing, especially in the product, we didn't really deal with this in the research systems, is to have a kind of smooth adaptation from an under to an overload situation, right? So, you can't, in the absence of knowledge of the workload, you can't make a real-time guarantee for anything, right? Because if people are consuming memory at too high a rate, you may just not be able to collect fast enough. And so when the system goes into overload, you need to deal with that in a clean way. That'll happen, for instance, in those telco systems where they're queue-based. And sometimes the queue, right, like if there's a disaster, everyone tries to call their mother, and, you know, that'll generate the sort of transient overload where they'd rather have the calls take longer than expected than to have them that get interrupted, although they also do something called admission control that prevents too many calls from getting started. And then, as I said, we've done this in a production machine.
How can you get parameters for the scheduling again?
How can you guarantee that, you know, for example, the incremental fed garbage collector fed will be scheduled, given that the decision is not yours, but that of the operators?
So we are relying on certain properties of the operating system scheduler. This runs on Linux. We actually, RHEL 5 has kernel modifications that were made to support our virtual machine.
So you need to make kernel?
Yeah. If you don't have a real-time kernel, you can't build a real-time virtual machine on top of it. Interestingly, the reason that they were willing to put in all of these kernel mods for us was, and this kind of gets back to your question, that the things that we wanted to guarantee real-time behavior meant, like, that they couldn't hold locks for long periods of time. And it turned out that that was really important for them for SMP scalability. And so there was this kind of synergy between SMP scalability and real-time performance. Yeah?
Are you saying that your system acts differently when it's underloaded and it's when it's overloaded with the 450 limit that you have?
It's not the pauses themselves, but it's kind of the fraction of the overall processing resource that you can devote to the application. So if the system is not overloaded, we can guarantee this and guarantee something about the way they're spaced out, right? If you overload the system, then we may have to violate that in order to make sure that there's that the system doesn't run out of memory.
And if you violate that, it's not real time anymore with that boundary.
Sure, right.
In a missile system or something like that that is defense oriented, how does it react in that situation?
Well, so there's no free lunch, right? So, I mean, people who build real-time systems, like that music system, in some sense, the definition of a hard real-time system is that we know that it will never go into overload, right? So typical classical periodic hard real-time systems, avionics, ABS control, are always over-provisioned because if there's no slack, it means you blew it, right? So in the absence of some knowledge about the application, I mean, it doesn't forget the garbage collector, right? If you can't guarantee that your application won't overload your resources, right? It doesn't matter whether you wrote it in C or in Java. I think we'll see some of those issues come up as we go through the system. A question up here?
Okay.
I didn't have something in there, but I'll try to add some material on that. Okay. So this may kind of get to some of the issues that you've been bringing up. What does real-time mean? So it means minimal predictable interruption of the application, right? So we want the interruptions to be very short, but it's crucial for the application writer that those interruptions are also predictable in some way. Of course, it's really important that the collection finishes before the heap is exhausted, right? If I'm running along and giving you these very nice short pauses and they're very nicely spaced, but then I suddenly run out of memory, I have to bring the whole system to a stop while I go and free up some memory. One way to think of that is that it's kind of a meta-level priority inversion, right? That is that you are trying to set things up so that the collector ran in some sense at a lower priority than the application, but if you run out of space, suddenly the application threads all grind to a halt and the collector is running at a higher priority. So another thing is that it has to be real space. This turned out to be one of really the key insights and unique aspects of our system. If you go back and look in the literature, there's tons of papers before our stuff that, you know, said a real-time garbage collector. But almost all of them relied in some way on these kind of tricks of ignoring various pathological behaviors. And one way to cheat is to not have, is to say, well, we bounded, you know, none of our pauses are longer than 2 milliseconds. But that kind of doesn't mean anything if you can't say something about how much memory you need to consume to make that guarantee, right? So, so you need to have your entire memory architecture and your algorithm set up so that you can say something like, well, if the application data never goes above 3 megabytes, then we'll never consume more than 5 megabytes of RAM, right? Because if you don't do that, then, you know, so when someone deploys this system in your car with 5 megabytes of RAM and the algorithm fragments memory and suddenly needs more than 5 megabytes, it's going to come crashing to a halt. I'm not entirely sure of the distinction that you're making, but basically, you know, each object in the system may have a certain amount of overhead associated with it. Well, from the programmer's perspective, that's not their memory, that's extra crap that the virtual machine is requiring. There may also be metadata that the system needs. That needs to be bounded. The memory architecture may also induce fragmentation. That needs to be bounded. There may also be extra memory that you have that you need to consume because the application continues to allocate while you're collecting. That has to be counted. You have to account for all of that stuff and be able to say, here's my guarantee about how much memory I'm going to consume. And so as we go through, you'll see how we do some of these things. And we have to honor the thread priorities, and I think I'm going to come back to this issue later. Okay, so we've been calling this thing a garbage collector. But it's not, that kind of really gives you the wrong impression because it's really a memory management subsystem. So there's this sort of cycle of life that things go through. You have free memory, you allocate out of it, you mutate it, and then you free it up again. And so we're actually going to spend a pretty large amount of the time talking about memory allocation before we ever talk about collecting the memory, because these things are very intimately bound together. So let's talk now about how we organize the memory. So we have a page-based memory architecture. So we take our memory space and we cut it up into pages. And then each page is further divided up into cells of some fixed size, fixed for that page, right? So here's a page with small objects on it, and here's a page with large objects on it. And Then we have what are called segregated free lists, which chain together free cells within a page and then chain together pages of that size. So now, kind of getting to the one of, you know, one aspect of the question you asked, a key thing is that there's a ratio that we maintain between the sizes of the cells on the pages. Okay, so so for instance, if we want, so we want to account for fragmentation that's happening because of this architecture. There's two kinds of fragmentation. You've got the fragmentation that's going on up there because the objects aren't quite big enough to fill up their cells, right? So we call that internal fragmentation. There's another kind of fragmentation that goes on if you have wasted space at the end of the page. The size of the object doesn't exactly divide the page size. Okay, and we call that page internal fragmentation. So there's no way of preventing that per se,